You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
My guest today is Robert Keller, QC, of One Crown Office Row. Robert's areas of specialism include clinical negligence, professional discipline and regulation in the world of healthcare. He acts for doctors, dentists, nurses and other regulated professionals in all types of regulatory and disciplinary cases. He also advises healthcare providers, organisations and individual practitioners in relation to a range of legal issues arising from the provision of healthcare. And this is what he's here to discuss with me today, the future of professional regulation in healthcare. It's particularly important to allow regulators to react to unexpected challenges, such as the recent COVID-19 emergency. Rob, welcome back to LawPod UK.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we're here to discuss the future of professional regulation in healthcare. Why is it a hot topic at the moment?
Well, it's certainly a hot topic in the last year or so. The government's published a couple of major documents which contain proposals directed at really overhauling the way in which professional healthcare regulation is done in the UK. The first of those is a major government white paper entitled Integration and Innovation, Working Together to Improve Health and Social Care for All. And that was published back in February of this year. And it sets out some legislative proposals for the Health and Social Care Bill. And really, those proposals were all about reorganising the way in which healthcare is regulated in this country, really at an institutional level. And the second major document, which practitioners will be aware of, is a government consultation paper called Regulating Healthcare Professionals, Protecting the Public. And that was published back in March of this year. It also deals with some institutional stuff, how things are going to be organised at an institutional level, or some proposals about that, but also at a micro level, some proposed reforms about the systems and processes in place for regulating healthcare professionals. And both of those documents have attracted a lot of interest from those who work in this area. There have been responses to the consultation by all of the regulators. The medical defence organisations have all responded, together with leading professional organisations like the Association of Regulation and Disciplinary Lawyers. But the important thing about these two major documents is it gives us an idea of the sorts of things that are coming over the horizon in the next few years in the regulatory space, if I can put it that way.
Well, I suppose the pandemic has sharpened everybody's mind, but we've been here before, haven't we?
Well, yes. I mean, there have been a slew of proposals in the last decade or so. In 2013, we had the Francis Inquiry, which was all about serious failings in the Mid-Staffs NHS Trust. And that recommended that more needed to be done to ensure effective accountability to the public and a simpler regime of regulation for healthcare professionals. Then we had in 2014 a major Law Commission report, and that made some recommendations aimed at consolidating and simplifying the existing legal framework. And it recommended that there should be greater consistency between all of the regulatory bodies. And then again in 2017, we had another consultation which suggested that regulation in this country needed to be more proportionate, more responsive, and we needed more efficiency. But I think really these latest developments suggest that the government really is now serious about pushing through some of the lessons learned or some of the recommendations made by those earlier inquiries and reports.
So, Robert, could you take us through the white paper first and give us some of the main proposals?
Well, yes, as far as the white paper is concerned, which of course is the first of the two things I mentioned, the premise really of that white paper, so far as regulatory reform is concerned, is that at an institutional level in this country, the way in which professional regulation is organised is simply too complex and too unwieldy. And the authors of the white paper take the view that all of that needs to be rationalise. It may come as a surprise, I think, to some listeners to know that there are no less than 9 separate organisations in the UK responsible for regulating healthcare. We've got the General Medical Council, the General Dental Council, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, and then we have the General Chiropractic Council, the General Optical Council, the General Osteopathic Council, the General Pharmaceutical Council, and then finally the Health and Care Professionals Council and the Pharmaceutical Council of Northern Ireland. And given that shopping list, the view has been taken by the government that there's scope for rationalisation and reducing the total number of regulations and actually reorganising the way in which those regulators perform their functions.
I suppose that the proliferation of bodies in any area of committees and so on, it's a form of entropy, isn't it? And how do you reverse that? How is the government going to go about simplifying it?
Well, in short, as I read the proposals, they're going to give the Secretary of State effectively a legislative wrecking ball to do as he or she sees fit, by which I mean the Secretary of State will get wide-ranging legislative powers in a number of areas. They can, using their power, remove entire professions from the scope of regulation, for example. It's envisaged by the government that some of the professions that are currently subject to professional regulation don't need to be, and that as technology develops, as practices develop, roles develop, then the risk profile of certain professions, certain regulated professions, may reduce to the extent that regulation is no longer necessary or appropriate. Now, the white paper doesn't, as it were, name names, but some of the regulated professions at the moment include dietitians and clinical scientists, just as an example. And the government may take the view that it's no longer proportionate in the future to regulate professions like that. The government's also granting power to the Secretary of State to abolish some of the regulators altogether, the thinking being that there's going to be duplication in having 9 separate regulators all performing similar functions with different professions, and that there could be room, as it were, to merge perhaps some of the regulators or abolish some of them. And the idea is that that will lead to greater consistency and some financial and efficiency savings. There's also a proposal that individual regulators will have a power to delegate their functions to others. Again, another way of trying to rationalise, to increase efficiency savings in the provision of regulation in this country.
I just wanted to pick up on your point about technology. I'm thinking, you've been on this podcast before talking about AI in healthcare. Say, for example, in radiology, where AI is making great progress, would that be an area where perhaps regulation would not be so necessary because it would be AI rather than human diagnosticians that were at the centre of the picture?
Well, that's a very good question. I suppose it depends what kind of timeline we're looking at. Speaking for myself, I can't imagine a time when radiologists per se are beyond the scope of regulation. Certainly in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, there's always going to need to be, I would have thought, sufficient human input into things like radiology to require them to be regulated. But I suppose if we were to look on a longer time scale, perhaps when you and I won't be here anymore, 50, 100 years, we may come a time when radiology doesn't really exist as a profession, that all of this is done through AI, through computers, begging the question, I suppose, as to whether the computers themselves need regulation, or the software needs regulation. I mean, it's a very good point. But I think the short answer is, at least in the short term, there's always going to be sufficient human input into AI that the humans will require some sort of oversight and regulation, would be my view.
So for the moment, at least, regulators needn't be engineers or computer programmers.
Not for the moment.
So moving on to the government consultation paper about the regulation of healthcare professions, what are its themes and objectives?
So the government's proposal suggests that the reform of professional regulation should be guided by five principles. Two of those are pretty conventional: public safety, respecting registrants' rights. But three of those are quite interesting and perhaps less conventional in the regulatory forum. And those are efficiency and cost. Firstly, this idea that the legislation governing professional regulation is very detailed and should be rationalised and replaced, and that the cost of regulation should be minimised wherever possible, provided this is consistent with public protection. Then we have this idea of consistency as a principle. That means consistency as between regulators. Regulators should have broadly equivalent powers to maintain a level of effective public protection evenly between regulators. And then this idea of flexibility and autonomy, that individual regulators should be well placed to respond, for example, to changing workforce models and changes in the development of healthcare delivery.
Autonomy seems to be very important in this paper. Why is that?
Well, it's because the current position is that regulators at the moment are all governed by statute and by statutory instrument. And that gives rise to inflexibility. The statutory requirements include a requirement to consult and if changes are going to be made. And the parliamentary process means that it can often take up to 2 years for regulators to implement even pretty simple changes to their own rules and procedures. And this, it's thought, restricts the ability of regulators to be nimble on their feet and to adapt quickly to changing circumstances. And so the proposal of the government is that regulators should be empowered to set more of their own operating procedures without getting parliamentary approval. And they can just do things as they see fit, as they go along. On the other hand, say the government, there's recognition that this greater autonomy does need to be balanced with greater accountability. And so to achieve that, there's an idea that regulators will need to provide annual reports to the Privy Council, setting out how they have performed. And the Privy Council will have a default power where regulators are thought to have failed to step in and direct how they should perform their functions. In addition, to achieve accountability, there's this idea that regulators will have to provide annual reports on what they're doing and what they've achieved to Parliament. So autonomy balanced with accountability is the government's idea.
But even so, there may be downsides to autonomy, do you think?
Well, and there are going to be upsides and downsides. I mean, some will welcome it, will welcome the flexibility that affords. But I do think it comes with some risks. I think it's important to recognise that the interests of regulators and the practitioners they regulate won't always be perfectly aligned. There'll be a temptation, for example, for some regulators to emphasise and prize or prioritise cost cutting and efficiency over the needs of fairness of practitioners and procedural rigour, or perhaps to weigh the public interest, the interest in protecting the public, more heavily than the private rights and interests of regulated professionals. And it might be objected that the critics of autonomy might say that Parliament and the government is much better placed to strike that balance correctly. At least they're in a more neutral position to do so than the regulators themselves. Speaking for myself, I'm not convinced that the requirement to report to Parliament or the ability of the Privy Council to step in is really an adequate balance against those risks. I would foresee is that the reality being that Parliament or the Privy Council are unlikely to really intervene in what a regulator wants to do, other than in the most extreme circumstances. So it's not going to be a particularly strong ballast against an overreaching regulator. And finally, I think it's quite difficult to see how this greater autonomy that's going to be afforded to regulators sits with this overarching objective of consistency as between regulators. I would have thought that greater autonomy gives rise to a greater risk, really, of divergence between the way in which regulators do things, and it's likely to lead to less consistency. I think ultimately how all of this shake out remains to be seen. The proof will be in the pudding, I think.
Yeah, we'll just have to see what happens. So in these new proposals, is it proposed that regulators will have any other eye-catching duties or powers?
Well, yes, there are going to be some new duties, a duty of cooperation for regulators. They're going to be obliged to work closely with one another and with other actors in the healthcare system to provide public protection. There'll be a new duty of transparency, the presumption being that all hearings are in public unless there are strong public interests for that not to happen. A duty of consultation in respect of any changes in rules or standards, and also a duty of proportionality, so that before making any changes to their own regulatory framework, regulators are going to have to do a proper impact assessment, taking in the views of patients, healthcare professionals, and other stakeholders. So those are the duties. So far as powers are concerned, I think one of the most eye-catching powers is the power of regulators to delegate functions to other regulators or third parties. At the moment, we have a situation where we have lots of different regulators all replicating the same function. So, for example, they all have their own separate hearing centres. The General Dental Council has a hearing centre in London. The General Medical Council has one in Manchester, and others have their own separate committee rooms. And I suppose this power of delegation envisages that different regulators, let's say the GDC, the General Dental Council, and the General Medical Council, might want to, for example, share hearing centres, might want to share committee members and pool their functions. And so that's something which I can see leading in the future to more efficiency, better cost savings, and perhaps just greater rationalisation of the way in which different disparate regulators do things.
I think that the time has come to have a look at the situation from the practitioner, or I think the word is the registrant's point of view, because of course this all really is about the procedure that takes place when there's a problem or a complaint. So what are the major changes proposed by the government?
Well, at the moment, the rules and procedures that are in play will vary depending upon which regulator you're before. So different regulators have very different procedural rules. Now, what is proposed by the government is that we're going to have much greater uniformity, and in future, all regulated professionals will be investigated and, as it were, disciplined or regulated in three stages. We'll have an initial assessment phase, first of all, then a case examiner stage, and finally a fitness to practice panel stage. Those are the three uniform stages. Now, those three labels, those three descriptions will sound pretty familiar, I should say, to those who practice in this world. But the way in which those stages work, for example, in the General Dental Council or the General Medical Council, is going in the future to be very different. There are going to be important differences in the way they operate. The idea being that these differences will lead to swifter resolution, lead to less adversarial hearings and actually less fully contested fitness to practice hearings. That's the idea.
Okay, so let's take this a step at a time. What will the initial assessment phase, as it's called, involve?
Well, if we just take a concrete examples, if you were a practitioner before the General Dental Council or the General Medical Council, the initial stage of the investigation would be performed by the registrar, and the registrar would perform an initial investigation into the complaint, and their function is to work out whether there is an allegation which amounts to an allegation that a practitioner's fitness to practice is impaired by misconduct or health or a lack of competence or something like that. So that's their job, but they have a pretty limited role. If they come to the view in this initial investigation that there is an allegation at least of impaired fitness to practice, then under the current statutory regime, they are obliged to send the case off to the next stage of the process, which is the case examiner stage, where the case gets looked at in a lot more detail. The proposals of the government is that at that initial, as it were, SIFT stage, much more power should be afforded to the regulator to make a decision on what should happen. There's a new power simply to decide that it's unnecessary for any further action to be taken because it's disproportionate or unnecessary, and simply to close the case down, even if there's an allegation that fitness practice is impaired. And the idea is that that will be accompanied by a new right for registrants to make submissions during the course of the initial stage about whether or not the investigation should continue or be closed down. At the moment, no such right exists, but the government's proposing that it should be introduced.
Does that sound like a sensible proposal to you?
Well, I think on the face of it, it is a sensible proposal. One assumes that the purpose is that a greater number of investigations are going to be disposed of summarily at an early stage in the investigation. Perhaps the idea is that only the more serious cases get investigated further by the case examiners, or if necessary, at a full hearing before a fitness to practice panel. My only, I think, reservation would be it's not entirely clear at the moment what test is going to be applied by the registrar in determining whether or not to close down a case. Is it going to be an issue of whether it's in the public interest to do so? Is there going to be a test of proportionality? Is the test going to be a test that the case examiners presently perform or apply, which is whether there's a realistic prospect of a finding of impairment at a later stage? Or is there going to be just a freewheeling discretion? And my own view is that we're going to need to have some better and some further guidance on what test the registrar is going to apply. That's going to be important to achieve consistency, to ensure that decisions are made of the requisite quality. And also as a matter of fairness, I mean, if practitioners are going to be able to make submissions that allegations, investigations should be closed down right at the very outset, the practitioners are going to need a target to aim at. What's the test? What are we making submissions about? So those would be my reservations. But I think on the face of it, at least at first blush, it's a sensible suggestion.
And then what changes are proposed to the case examiner stage?
Well, at present, the case examiner is, the second filter stage in the process, certainly in the General Medical Council and the General Dental Council. What happens is that the registrars, if there's, an allegation, they refer it to the case examiners who look at it in a bit more detail and work out whether to send it to a full fitness to practice panel to look at for a full hearing. But it's important to recognise that at the moment, the way the system works is that the case examiners don't actually make any findings of fact, and they don't come to any substantive conclusions about what happened or indeed whether the practitioner's fitness to practice is impaired. The only question really that the case examiners ask themselves at the moment is whether there's a realistic prospect that a fitness to practice panel later down the line will find impairment. If so, they can refer the matter for a full hearing. Apart from that, case examiners have a pretty limited menu of options in terms of how to dispose of the case. They can try and agree undertakings with a practitioner if they take the view that that's a proportionate way of dealing with any risk. Undertakings, for example, about how the practitioner will conduct themselves in the future, clinically or otherwise, or case examiners can deal with things by simply issuing a warning. So three options: referral to the fitness to practice panel, offering undertakings, or warning. And what is now proposed is really a quite radical shake-up, that the case examiners are going to be allowed to make findings on the facts, make findings about whether fitness to practice is impaired, and a power to conclude cases with a full suite of measures that would ordinarily or previously have only been open to fitness to practice panels. So they could impose conditions, they could suspend practitioners, or in the most serious cases, case examiners will be able to erase practitioners from the register. But it's important to recognise that array of options is only open to the case examiners in two situations. One, where the practitioner themselves agrees the proposal, or second, if the proposal is made and the practitioner fails to respond within 28 days. The idea is this is not going to be a negotiation between practitioner and case examiners. You're going to get an outcome if you're a practitioner, which you can either accept or reject. If you accept it, that's the end of the case. If you reject it, we go off to a fitness to practice panel hearing. So that is quite a radical shakeup of the existing system.
What is your view of this radical shakeup? Do you think it's a good thing, bad thing?
Well, I think I've got some mixed feelings about it, really. The advantages are that it will allow for, as it were, consensual resolution at a much earlier stage in the process. And no doubt for many doctors, dentists, nurses, that's going to reduce stress, avoid delay, avoid expenditure. So in that sense, this kind of front loading is a good thing. It has some advantages. But I do have some serious reservations. It puts a lot of power in the hands of the case examiners. And what's important to recognise is that those case examiners are only deciding things on the papers. They may have some submissions before them from the professional. They will have lots of documentary evidence. But at the end of the day, they're making a paper determination. I think it's certainly open to question whether it's appropriate for determinations about very serious matters. So allegations of dishonesty, allegations of sexual misconduct, and other things really at the top of the spectrum, whether it's ever really appropriate for such serious allegations to be determined on the papers. A view might be taken that allegations which are really at that end of the spectrum require a much more careful and nuanced assessment of the evidence, and that only really a full hearing will do where it's possible to test allegations, test evidence under cross-examination, and scrutinise it with the necessary care. So that, I think, is the concern. The response to that, I suppose, is to say, well, if practitioners are unhappy with the proposed outcome, they can always opt for a hearing. They can always say, well, no, I don't agree with that outcome. I want my day in court and my day before the fitness to practice panel. But in reality, my own view is that there, certainly in serious cases, there will be considerable pressure on practitioners to accept a sanction, perhaps short of suspension or short of erasure, rather than taking the risk of going to the fitness to practice panel and getting something worse. And that pressure will be particularly acute for those registrants who don't have professional representation. So that I think, is a concern. I think another concern is whether case examiners are adequately trained at the moment to make such important decisions. For example, at the moment, unlike the situation before a fitness to practice panel, case examiners don't ordinarily, so far as I'm aware, have very much by way of legal training. There's no legal assessor that sits with or legal advisor that sits with the case examiners to advise them on legal issues. And so this begs the question, are they adequately trained to take these decisions? Or are the constitution, so to speak, of case examiner panels, committees, do they need to be changed? Do we need to add better experience, legal advisors into the mix when decisions are going to be made at this stage? I mean, I think ultimately the fairness of this new proposed process is going to depend a lot upon resourcing. Unless they are properly resourced, for example, by getting detailed expert evidence at an early stage to assist the case examiners with decisions on clinical matters, there's going to be a risk of unfairness in the decisions that are made, and a greater risk that the decisions that are made are going to be rejected by practitioners, which will, I think, undermine the reforms. I think whatever happens, the practical implication of this reform is going to be that the case examiner stage becomes much more important in the future. Solicitors, defence organisations on both sides are going to need to devote much more resource to that stage, perhaps involve counsel more often, and certainly just work the case up to a greater degree at a much earlier stage.
So we've been talking about the perspective of the registrants, the practitioners, but have these reforms been universally supported by the regulators themselves?
Well, certainly the General Medical Council, which is still, I suppose, the leading, the major regulator, has welcomed and supported the vast majority of the proposed reforms. It's fair to say that some of the proposals have been less popular or received less support. So, for example, one of the proposals is that the grounds for action in fitness to practice cases should be reduced just to two categories, one being misconduct and the other being lack of competence. And the GMC, for example, takes the view that this is an unnecessary reduction in the grounds and is potentially dangerous. So, for example, say the GMC, there could be a risk to the public where there is a lack of knowledge of English on the part of a doctor, which compromises their ability to act safely. And that can't neatly be described as misconduct or lack of competence. Similarly, ill health has conventionally been a basis for regulators to act. Again, it's not clear how that fits into misconduct or lack of competence. And the GMC point out that it's not really fair to stigmatise a sick doctor, a doctor with ill health, as one who lacks competence. So that's not been well received. I think from a practitioner's point of view, there are some proposals which will be less popular. I mean, speaking for myself, one of the government's proposals, which I think needs some rethinking, is the proposal to scrap the five-year rule. Certainly in general medical council cases, it has for many years been a rule that cases which are more than 5 years old or arise from allegations which are more than 5 years old can't be proceeded with unless it's in the public interest. Now, the government suggests that should be scrapped. I don't agree with that. I think that's an important safeguard against stale complaints. I don't see that it's in the public interest to pursue cases which are more than 5 years old unless it can be shown that there's a very good reason to do so, particularly given that ultimately what the regulator is supposed to be looking at is whether fitness practice is currently impaired. And the further one gets away from the index events, the less readily I think the argument can be made that a registrant's fitness practice is impaired. So I think that's a retrograde step. I'm sure there'll be others, though, who have different views.
Well, that's a very interesting summing up of what is about to happen. We're discussing this at the end of October, beginning of November 2021. What happens next, Robert?
Well, all of the responses to the government's consultation went in, so far as I'm aware, in June of this year. And I understand that the government is, as it should be, considering all of those responses with some care. The next stage will be that once the government has decided its response to the consultation, it will bring forward some draft legislation. I would have thought the first in the queue will be the General Medical Council. I would have thought, if I was a betting man, that we'll see some draft legislation in the course of 2022. We might see it before, but I think unlikely, with other draft legislation to follow for the other regulators.
And your final thoughts on these proposed reforms?
Well, I suppose just that they are pretty far-reaching and that practitioners need to be aware of what's coming. I think it's too early really to predict what exactly is going to happen. I suppose from my own perspective, there are really three trends. I think we're going to see greater autonomy in general for regulators, more autonomy to change their own rules and procedures and to be flexible about that. I think we're going to see more rationalisation of functions, more sharing of functions and duties as between regulators. And perhaps most importantly, I think we're going to see much more front-loading of the process. So at the moment, those who work in the field realise that there's a lot of work up done, but the most intensive work is really done at the end of the process, when things get towards the fitness of practice panel stage, as it were, to trial. I think in future we're going to see much more front-loading of the process, so more work is going to be done by everybody right at the beginning, whether that's at the registrar stage, at the case examiner stage, with a view to trying to dispose of cases at the earliest possible opportunity. So I think that's the biggest change, but those will be the three things which I think are headed for us over the horizon.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for doing the hard work for us, as it were, taking us through this long consultation paper and the white paper. Thank you so much for explaining it so clearly. We'll see, as you say, the proof will be in the pudding.
Precisely. No, thank you for having me.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.